So we started this evening with the dedication ceremony, followed by a period of meditation. And this is a talk where I'm going to just explore a little of Sangharakshita's ideas about the importance of devotional practice and in the context of Shraddha or faith. And then, we've got lots of examples of devotional practice, but there's the two that we've been... Well, there's one that we've done at the beginning of the session, there's one that we're doing at the end of the session, so we'll have an actual experience of devotional practice as well as me talking about it, and also go into more detail into both of those. So I thought maybe I would just start with a little bit on... Well, why... Why would we do it? So Sangharakshita is quite interesting because if you look at his writings, there's a lot of writings where he's, you know, translating the teachings, translating the Dharma, trying to get the concepts across, you know, trying to be as clear as possible so that we can understand it. And he's very sort of keen that we understand the Dharma. But there's also another side of him where he's saying, well, the rational mind is not enough. You know, when we practice, you know, practicing the Dharma, the path of transforming ourselves is actually very challenging. You know, we need to stay motivated and we also need to be able to keep going when the times are tough. And in order to do that, most of us, we need to have something that's drawing us. You know, something that makes it worth that. And something that, you know, gets us engaged in the first place. So I was talking earlier about that idea of call and response and our response to the Buddha or the Dharma and the Sangha. Something inside us resonates with them. So that is where we come to the Buddhist concept of faith or Shraddha, which is slightly different to the sort of way that faith is often used in the West. So Shraddha has got some roots in terms of where we place our heart, you know, so what is most important to us, what is most meaningful to us. And that response to something more meaningful, that maybe we respond to the Buddha, the stories of the Buddha, the myth of the Buddha, the images of the Buddha. I've come across people who come across just a rupa and been so moved by it that they've then decided they want to become a Buddhist. You know, other people, it may be they come across a teaching and that really moves them, or a sense of truth or a sense of, yes, recognition, and that is what inspires them to explore the Dharma, follow the path. And some people, you know, their starting point might be meeting somebody who's practicing and feeling really inspired by them, or somehow feeling there's a sense of their practice being communicated. You know, you may just not know quite what it is, something quite mysterious, but there's something different about that person that sort of attracts you. You know, maybe they've got a quality of kindness, or maybe they've got a quality of sort of like equanimity, or they've got sort of wisdom. There's all kinds of different sort of dharmic qualities that we develop along the path. And when we meet people who are practicing, sometimes we recognise that. Even if it's not conscious, we recognise that and we are drawn to that. I know for myself, I was drawn, I think, most strongly, first of all, to the Dharma and to meditation, which I suppose is a practice from the Dharma. And then I kind of find myself responding to the Buddha, but it took me a long time to be able to connect with the Sangha. But even so, right from the start, there was some Buddhist that I met who had something very special, and that I wanted to be around them. I wanted to go to things that they were leading. And I didn't think it was because they were Buddhist, but at a certain point I had to sort of be honest with myself and think, well, a lot of the people that I feel that with are Buddhist, so maybe there is actually a connection between practicing the Dharma and, you know, the effect it has. And maybe I want to sort of do that too, you know, bring that out more in myself. So, whether it's to the Buddha, the Dharma, or Sangha, that kind of response is what I would call Shraddha. You know, there's something in us that resonates with the... It's hard to know what language to use, but something sort of more transcendental, something unconditioned, something from a dimension or a level of meaning and experience beyond our mundane lives and our experience of ourselves and the world at that point. A glimpse of potential, a glimpse of our innate Buddha nature, if you want to use that kind of language. Because we all do have the potential to become like the Buddha. The Buddha was a human being. He was a man who followed the path, and he had this incredible insight, this awakening of his heart and his mind, that we call enlightenment. And he was able to communicate that, so I think that is something that's really kind of quite unique, that he was, you know, at the beginning, he wasn't sure if he could, whether anybody else would be able to get that. That's kind of quite lovely bit in one of the suttas where after he's becoming enlightened, he's thinking that it'd be tiresome to try and communicate it because nobody would understand it. But luckily for us, he did, and he did find someone who did understand, and then after that, he spent, I don't know, over 40 years travelling around teaching the Dharma. And we've got this big legacy of his teachings and practices, which is the Dharma, which gives us the opportunity to follow in his footsteps for us to realise that potential too. You know, and that is also an expression of the Buddha. The Buddha talked about those who saw his body, his physical body, they weren't really seeing him, but those people who, you know, were seeing the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, understanding Dharma, those were the people who saw him. So he's definitely saw the Dharma. That's really himself, really, the Buddha. So yes, I've gone a little bit over on that, but basically the idea is that there's something transcendental or something inside us that resonates when we recognise that, you know, our own Buddha nature, our own possibilities of growing, developing, transforming. And that is Shraddha. So that involves a certain amount of receptivity, spiritual receptivity, to those qualities, whether we experience them through the Buddha, through the teachings, through other practitioners, or maybe through the archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and referring to those. So when we do that, we're engaging on a more emotional level, and sometimes we're engaging with a part of our mind that is a little bit more unconscious. It's not so much our thinking, planning, cognitive mind, our rational mind, because that's only just a part of our minds, it's only just a part of ourselves. So Sangha has very much said that we have to bring all of ourselves into our spiritual practice, which includes the unconscious parts of ourselves and the parts that may respond much more to the language of symbol, imagery, myth, poetry, ritual. And that is one reason why I think you will find in every Buddhist tradition there will be people doing some kind of chanting or devotional practice to sort of contact and express that side. And it is a practice. Yeah, devotional practice is a practice. So just like meditation is a practice, the more we do it, the more effect it will have, and also the more receptive we might be, the more it may open us up to different aspects of ourselves, our practice, and the teachings. So just as, you know, practicing ethics can help us to transform our actions in the world and the way that we react and respond to what we encounter in the world, to, in a way, learn to act from our better impulses, our better qualities, you know, more skillfully, more ethically. And just as meditation can be a way of bringing more awareness, transforming our minds, our mental states, so too can devotional practice be a way of transforming ourselves, opening our hearts and our minds to... Well, I don't know what to say there, but yeah, opening our minds to, the three jewels, actually, of the Buddha, the Dharma and Sangha, and what is most important to us if we are practicing Buddhists, what lies at the heart of our practice. So, yeah, hopefully when you did the dedication ceremony you had some kind of response. It may be that you've been to other kinds of rituals, like a sevenfold puja, done a threefold puja, and maybe you've liked it, maybe you haven't, maybe you felt completely confused or resistant or whatever. But I would encourage you, whatever your experience is, to just keep on trying, seeing what happens each time. Certainly for me, I was like very, very reactive. Yeah, very, very reactive. I think my first puja I kind of went away and didn't come back for about a year. But but that, you know, I think that was because there was something strong in me, you know, reacting to that. And when I was able to work with that, come to terms with that, when I was actually able to stop trying to control everything, judge everything, in a way surrender myself, open myself to devotional practice, then something really profound happened, and it's been very much an inspiration and a guide to me, and almost, yeah, something that's really helped me on my personal path. So when we're doing the dedication ceremony, well, what is dedication? I was looking up a few definitions of dedication, and a lot of them were about committing something. Apparently, it originated in sort of like the 14th century when it was being used in a more Christian context to sort of dedicate, you know, a place. You know, so there's a sense of something becoming more sacred. You know, and then since then, obviously, it's been used in lots of different contexts, often in a sort of more secular context. But there is often a sense of something that's important, you know, dedicating something to a particular purpose, a particular use. You know, in terms of someone who's dedicated, there's a sense that they are devoted, that they are committed, that they put a lot of energy wholeheartedly, that is something that they really think is of value. And often you'll find people will dedicate things to people that they admire or that they feel gratitude towards. So, in the dedication ceremony, obviously there's a sense of gratitude, admiration, respect towards the Buddha, and also towards the three jewels. Yeah. So I'm just going to start looking at the actual words of the dedication ceremony and just sort of riffing off it a little bit, my thoughts. And then after a little while, we'll start looking also at the threefold puja. So, it starts by saying that we dedicate ourselves to the three jewels. So, the three jewels are at the centre of Buddhist practice, and the three jewels are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So, in the dedication ceremony, he doesn't go into much detail, he just, you know, acknowledges that that's what we're going for refuge to, but there's also added to each of those a phrase of something we're doing in relation to it. So to the Buddha, the ideal of enlightenment to which we aspire. So very much that sense that we're connecting to our aspirations of what we could be. You know, when we bow to the Buddha, when we make offerings to the Buddha, we're not doing it as some creator god that's so far above us and we're just sort of bowing to him. We are bowing to him as someone who has, you know, come a lot further than we have, who's shown the way, who we respect, and who in a way embodies or symbolises the full potential that we could achieve as human beings. And the aspiration for us also to follow in his footsteps, to become more and more like the Buddha, to develop those qualities in ourselves. Then there's to the Dharma and the path of the teaching which we follow. So just making it explicit that the Dharma isn't just something that you read. You know, there's so much out there now. There's loads and loads of books, there's loads and loads of, well, actually now we can listen to loads and loads of talks on the internet, download them, watch them on YouTube or whatever, go to lots of talks. You know, at the time when Sangharakshita wrote this, there was very little Buddhist text in translation over here in the West. But that's, we've had such a proliferation, and also we've had lots of different, you know, Buddhist schools coming over to the West and founding the West, so it's a very, very different situation. But what, you know, we can get a little bit overwhelmed by all the Dharma that's out there. But whatever bit of Dharma you go and you find resonates with you, that's enough, really, to take it on board to try and practice according to that. You know, you don't have to understand every single bit of the Dharma or have, you know, studied every single text. Well, you couldn't, actually. But if you find, you know, a verse, a particular teaching that you respond to, then you try and put that into practice. So it's just very explicitly saying that the Dharma, the path of the teaching, is something that we actively put into practice, we follow it. And then we talk about the Sangha, the spiritual fellowship with one another, which we enjoy. So again, there's a sense of it's something that we do, you know. We don't just come along and there's the Sangha. We engage with the Sangha. We create Sangha. We practice Sangha. And hopefully we do enjoy it at sometimes, but we may not always. Sometimes it can be quite challenging. But there's, you know, we go for refuge to the Sangha. So I'm just going to unpack that a little bit, because we go to refuge to what's sometimes called the Arya Sangha, the Sangha of enlightened beings, and also those who are so far along the path that their enlightenment is assured. So we're not going to refuge to each other and our local Sangha. Yeah. We're going to refuge to those who are, I suppose you could say, more spiritually further on the path than we are, and to people like the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas, enlightened beings. Yeah. But one of the ways in which we go for refuge is to practice Sangha. You know, and we are all an aspiring Sangha. We want to follow in their footsteps, develop their qualities, become like them. And one way of practicing Sangha is actually coming together to practice the Dharma. You know, whether it's meditation, whether it's study, whether we're, you know, working together as Buddhists, living together as Buddhists, going on retreat together, communicating with each other. You know, that is a way of practicing Sangha. Yeah. Anytime we come together with other Buddhists, we can practice Sangha. It's an opportunity. And when we do that, we support each other's practice. We can help each other to go more deeply. Yeah. So then there's some lines about we dedicate this place. So I just was thinking, well, when we say this place, what do we mean? Quite often we'll do the dedication ceremony, say, at the beginning of a retreat, so we might be dedicating the retreat in the shrine room with that particular combination of people. Sometimes if there's an opening, you know, when we first came here, we did dedication ceremonies in both of the shrine rooms to dedicate the place. Or sometimes, you know, just before a period of practice, like we did just now, we dedicated the place. This place, the shrine room, this physical space, you could say. But the space, for me, there's inner space and outer space. So when I'm doing the dedication ceremony, I also think that there's an element where I'm also dedicating it to the inner space, to my mind, basically, that I'm dedicating my mind to transformation, to following in the path of the Buddha. So then we have the words, here may no idle word be spoken, here may no unquiet thought disturb our minds. And then we say, to the observance of the five precepts, we dedicate this place. To the practice of meditation, we dedicate this place. To the development of wisdom, we dedicate this place. And to the attainment of enlightenment, we dedicate this place. So there's a sense of creating a sacred space for our practice and making explicit, you know, what we're going to do in that space. You know, so we're going to try and follow the precepts, you know, with ethical behaviour. We're going to try and meditate. We're going to try and develop insight and wisdom. And also, we're not just going to do it in order to become a bit more aware, a bit more happy, a bit more content, because actually when you follow the path, you probably will find at a certain stage you do find yourself feeling happier, more content. And then it's very easy to think, oh yeah, this is nice, you know, and use the Dharma as a way of making samsara more manageable, or, you know, your life more manageable, you know, just as a sort of like a panacea or a prop, you know. But, you know, so it's making it explicit, no, we want to go further than that, you know. We want to do it to attain enlightenment, you know. Then it says, though in the world outside there is strife, here may there be peace. Though in the world outside there is hate, here may there be love. Though in the world outside there is grief, here may there be joy. So, it's not about trying to withdraw and make us just, this is a nice place and the world's out there, we don't want to engage with the strife or the hate or the grief. But I think sometimes we do need to temporarily withdraw, we do need to develop our resources, we do need to practice contact with other aspects in order to be able to engage more fully with them in the world. But also there's a sense that we all actually, in our lives, we experience dukkha, we experience suffering in some kind of a way. So if we come and we sit here practicing, we are actually bringing all those things in there. So there's an element of, well, we're going to try and transform that. Yeah, we're going to try and transform the poisons that are underlying a lot of our behaviours, causing us suffering. We're going to try and transform our, you know, more negative mental states into positive mental states. So, yeah, so that's one aspect I would say of those lines. And not by the chanting of the sacred scriptures, so definitely the sense, and not by the sprinkling of holy water, that it's not just following rites and rituals, and we're trying to do it through our own practice. Yeah. So we're not going through the motions, we're not just following traditions or what the teachers were told us to do, but it's actually through our personal practice. Yeah. And that's what we're dedicating ourselves and our practice. Yeah. So then there's all the stuff about around this mandala, this sacred spot, and using the imagery of the lotus, like this, and also of the vajra. So, you know, I could spend the whole evening talking about either of those, but basically they're both symbols of enlightenment and reality. And also, you know, the lotus is very much a symbol of the path, that sense of unfolding, growing, opening. The vajra is the diamond thunderbolt. Is very much seen as a symbol of wisdom, and the lotus a symbol of compassion. You know, which are the two main strands, we would say, on the path and of enlightenment. The two wings of the bird, compassion and wisdom. So we're trying to develop both of them, but also be protected by both of those. Anyway, I'm not going to go into a lot of imagery about that because I would be here all night. But I do love them. And at some night I maybe do a night on the lotus or a night on the vajra. But yes, and you've also got the symbol of flames. And obviously flames and fire are very much associated with transformation. There's all that alchemical imagery of, you know, transforming base metal into gold, burning away impurities and all that kind of stuff. So there's a whole kind of metaphor going on there about us transforming ourselves through our practice. Yeah. And obviously, flames are also very much associated with inspiration and spirit and things like that. So, yeah, the final part of the dedication ceremony, you know, there's, think about here, sitting here, practicing. May our mind become Buddha, may our thought become Dharma, may our communication with one another be Sangha. So there's a kind of simplicity about here and now. You know, we're practicing meditation, we're with each other, we're communicating with each other, and we want to, you know, basically become more ethical, use that context for our practice. And actually, the more we practice, hopefully, the more aware we come, maybe the less reactive we come, maybe we develop a bit more insight, a little bit more kindness. We learn to sort of let go of some of our habits, conditioning, loosen some of our attachment, our greed, all those kinds of things that often drive us without us being aware of them. So in that respect, the more we practice, hopefully the more our minds will become like the Buddha. And sometimes we may have that experience where we're not aware of any of the hindrances or the poisons. We are just totally you know, absorbed, calm, still, feeling positive, feeling open, feeling interconnected in love. Those are all things that can happen practicing. So, yeah. We have that wish that our mind can become Buddha. And also, the more that we think about, the more that we reflect on the Dharma, the more we practice the Dharma, it becomes more our natural way of being, our habitual way of thinking. So in that respect, again, our mind, our thought can become Dharma. And again, when we are with other people, there's different ways that we can interact, different ways that we can come together. But if we are all coming together as people who are trying to go for refuge to the Three Jewels, that does mean that we will be trying to practice ethics and the precepts. That does mean, hopefully, that we all have values. You know, that kindness is important, that compassion is important, that truth, honesty, and all those things are important. And that creates a different kind of relationship and communication within a group, I think, when that is present. And that's, in a way, what we mean by may our communication become Sangha. And then finally, we talk about doing it for the happiness of all beings, for the benefit of all beings, with body, speech and mind. We dedicate this place. So what Sangha actually does in those final verses is he puts our practice into the context of altruistic practice. You know, we're not just doing it for ourselves, we're doing it hopefully to benefit others, benefit the world. And, well, we will be exploring this a bit later. There's this ideal that you get in the Tibetan tradition and, well, the Mahayana, where of course the Bodhisattva ideal, the idea of enlightened beings who are wanting to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Yeah, and we'll explore that a bit later. But we can all have that kind of element in our practice as well. That we're not just doing it for... And in fact, you can't just do it for yourself. You know, any time that you do become more kind, more aware, then that affects how you are with other people, you know. Anyway, so basically I'm going to leave the dedication ceremony there and then do a quick look at the threefold puja. So puja basically is a kind of devotional ritual. You could translate it as worship. And threefold refers to the fact that there are three sections. And each of the sections have got verses, sets of verses, where we're paying reverence to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. In the first two sets of verses, we have lines which explicitly begin with the words, we reverence the Buddha, we reverence the Dharma, we reverence the Sangha. So again, that sense of paying respect, paying homage, you know, acknowledging that there's something that we value. Yeah. The third set of verses, we express the reverence actually a bit more actively, shifting into the active tense. So, reverencing the Buddha, reverencing the Dharma, reverencing the Sangha. And I think that's because in that section we're talking about making offerings to the Buddha. So we're actually doing something physically as well. So each of the sections has got a title. So the first section is called Opening Reverence, second section, Reverence to the Three Jewels, and the final section, Offerings to the Buddha. So although in each of the sets of verses we're paying reverence to the Three Jewels, they all have a slightly different emphasis. So in the Opening Reverence, we're simply paying reverence to the Three Jewels, naming them and what they represent. You know, and the essential part that they play for those who are practicing the Dharma. We reverence the Buddha, the perfectly enlightened one, the sharer of the way. We reverence the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, which leads from darkness to light. We reverence the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples that inspires and guides. So with the words which leads from darkness to light, it's the idea of creating light, being able to see where before you couldn't see. You know, it's a very basic metaphor for wisdom, insight, enlightenment, you know, being able to see the path, follow the path. And also sort of being able to see through our conditioning, through our views and habits, this badger-like quality of cutting through often happens with that degree of insight, which is why it's very much associated with wisdom. With the reverence, the Sangha, the fellowship of the Buddha's disciples that inspires and guides, again, it's a reference both to the Arya-sangha of enlightened beings and also the aspiring Sangha that we're practicing alongside, the fellowship, you know, and the fact that we can receive inspiration and guidance from both of those that can help us on the path. And then we have the going for refuge to the Sangha. No, that is going for refuge to the Sangha, sorry, I'm getting my head wrong. Okay, so in the second section, we do reverence to the three jewels. And then in these, again, we're also linking to our aspirations and intended actions. So we reverence the Buddha and aspire to follow him. We reverence the Dharma, aspire to follow it. We reverence the Sangha, aspire to follow it. So you can see that there's sort of similarities with this and the dedication ceremony, that they're all basically different way of approaching going for refuge of the three jewels. But in this case, it also talks about what this might look like in practice. So we say, the Buddha was born as we are born. What the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome. What the Buddha attained, we too can attain. So there's a sense that we need to be very wholehearted in our commitment on the path. But that we can also attain what the Buddha attained. With the Dharma, we talk about the truth in all its aspects, the path in all its stages. We aspire to study, practice, and realise. So there's that sense of the Dharma as the truth, the Dharma as reality, the Dharma as the path, yeah, and that we want to engage with that really fully, all the aspects of that. And finally, we're encouraged to join the Sangha, recognise and acknowledge that we practice the path individually but also collectively. So I know we're reverencing the fellowship of those who tread the way. As one by one, we make our own commitment. An ever-widening circle, the Sangha grows. So there's that sense that, yes, we are on our individual path, but we're also doing it collectively. Then in the final section, all the reverences are to the Buddha, who obviously is the foundation. This, you know, there would be no Dharma, no Sangha without the Buddha. And you could also see the Dharma and the Sangha as expressions of the Buddha. And we offer him the three traditional offerings of candles, flowers, and incense. You know, so there's a lot of symbolism with all of those, but they also, each of them, represent one of the three jewels. So the candles represent the Buddha, the idea that the Buddha illuminates us with wisdom, you know, that we can follow his light. And there's also the sense that we have that light within us, you know, that we can light the flame of Bodhi wisdom within us in response to the Buddha. So there's actually a line, reverencing the Buddha, we offer candles. To him who is the light, we offer light. From his greater lamp, a lesser light, we light within us. The lamp of Bodhi shining within our hearts. So I think when we first respond to the Buddha, yes, our light is lesser, but the more and more we develop our own Bodhi, our own wisdom, then it becomes the same. There isn't like one Bodhi that's the Buddha's and one that's ours. It's just one. So there's this idea of the arising, the awakening of the heart and mind that's called Bodhicitta, which again I think we'll be exploring later in the series. Flowers symbolise the Dharma. And in a way, they also symbolise what you could see as the very key teaching of the Dharma. I think Sankaracharya once was asked, you know, if you had to summarise the Dharma in one word, what would you choose? And he said impermanence. Yeah. So obviously, flowers are a very as it were, a very clear example of that, you know. Especially cut flowers like this, they're very beautiful, but they very quickly die, they fade, they wither away. So that, you know, things change. We can't, even if we want them to stay the same, they don't. And in this verse, there's also explicit connection made with our own impermanence, which I think often we don't even want to acknowledge. I mean, we all know on one level that we're going to die, but actually, do we really? You know, I think we find it really hard to accept that. And we live our lives as if we're not going to. And actually, if we did actually take that on board, we would live our lives very, very differently, probably. So reverencing the Buddha, we offer flowers. Flowers that today are fresh and sweetly blooming. Flowers that tomorrow are faded and fallen. Our bodies too, like flowers, will pass away. And then finally, we make the offering of incense to the Buddha. So incense symbolises the Sangha. You know, when you light incense, the smoke travels all over the place, doesn't it? So there's a sense that the fragrance of the incense spreads in all directions, and it can actually spread quite a long way. So there's an analogy being made between this and the effect of practice on transforming ourselves and having an effect on the world, on other people we come into contact with. There's this concept of perfuming, you know, about somebody who's living a very ethical life. So Sangharakshita says, even a little Buddhist practice has an effect that carries beyond the individual psyche of the practitioner into their environment. The effect may not be tangible, but when your state of consciousness starts changing, it is as though the vibrations spread out into the surrounding atmosphere in ever-widening circles, having a positive influence on other living beings, whether they know it or not. And we can sometimes see the effect that we have on people, and sometimes we don't. And maybe years later, they come back to us and say, oh, that had an effect on me, you know, when you did this, when you said that, when you were kind to me. So we never quite know the effect we have, but if we just have that faith that if we practice, you know, if we practice and we try to be kind, try to be honest, try to be ethical, that it will have a beneficial effect on the people we come into contact with, and hopefully in the world. We can't change everything in the world, but we can change things within our sort of sphere of influence, so to speak. Then actually the world needs the Dharma, needs people practicing the Dharma. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sense of what both the dedication ceremony and the threefold puja are about. So we'll just have a couple of minutes, and then we're going to do the threefold puja.